Welcome to Internal Chatter, where we bring mental health into the daily dialogue. I'm your host, Melissa Beatty, and I'm joined by my co-host, Stacey Hunter. It's time to make mental health discussions a little lighter and elevate them into the daily dialogue of real life. Joining us on the chat today is Richard Ott, former Director of Risk Management and Internal Controls at Oregon State Hospital. Richard has worked in the healthcare field for over 25 years, with most of that time as a clinician and administrator. In his off-work hours, for more than a decade, Richard volunteered as a firefighter and EMT and saw firsthand the pernicious impacts that mental health and addiction-related issues have on individuals, families, and communities. Currently, Richard is working as a compliance and privacy officer, risk manager, and safety officer for the Portland Clinic. Not only do I know Richard, but Stacy also knows Richard, and we have a combined experience in the housing department at the University of Oregon when we were all students there.
Long, yes. Before the hair started turning gray.
Yes, I was thinking to myself, glasses are new for me since college. They just happened a year or two ago. But were you both wearing glasses in college?
I didn't wear my glasses, so I actually wouldn't recognize people from across the street. But I'm supposed to be wearing glasses since I was 13 years old.
Okay.
And due to vanity, when I was in college, I was wearing contacts mostly.
I see.
But yes, glasses were always on the bedside table.
Always there.
And I will say, too, I had eye surgery done, so there was a period of time when I did not need any correction, but of course got a little older, and things started needing to get closer and closer and then further and further away. So now... Yeah, my arms weren't quite long enough. Yeah.
Is that normal for the eye surgery? You maybe need another one later, like 20 years later, you still need more?
Yeah, the physician said, I can correct your vision. I can't give you new eyes. So it's not unusual for the vision to change as you get older. And that happens despite the surgery. So.
Well, Richard has a pretty impressive backstory and resume, in my opinion. He's been in the mental health field for so long. And the reason why we wanted to talk to him today is because I think that his experience in the mental health field brings a unique perspective in these kind of cycles of mental health that people experience, particularly in the Portland area. I feel like it intersects a lot with people who are unhoused, people who are getting into the system and staying in the system. They don't have a way out. They're finding it hard to get and keep care or have any sort of discipline with maintaining care. Such a big topic, it's hard to dive into. So maybe I'll just ask you, when you see people coming into the mental health system specifically, are there different cycles that you see?
You're absolutely right. It's a complicated issue that blends issues like you just mentioned of our homeless community. It blends drug addiction and mental health, which are far more combined than I think most people think it is. They just so closely go hand in hand. In particular, in the Portland area, it's a huge community issue, not only for funding and for safety. It blends into how the police deal with it, meaning the people, but also the situations that can be inherently unsafe. Unsafe for the people that are there, that are living on the street, but also unsafe for the community as a whole. As an example, in the time I have been working downtown, we've had two fires that I ended up intervening with because that's just what I do. I see the column of smoke rising from my downtown location from the window, and I grab a couple of fire extinguishers and head downstairs. And we've had two homeless
just from
camp,
out so a camp that's just near
like
your building,
literally across the street. In
and
one
it
case,
was right, out of control. You feel like it was getting out of control.
It would not have been long for it to get very out of control. You know, it's mid-August, not a good time to have an
outdoor fire.
And of course, in a protected location, it's going to be right by a bridge and right underneath a tree. That's just not safe. In the fire service, we have a what's referenced as the rule of thumb, and that is if there's a hazardous material and it's on fire, you should be far enough away that you can't see it. If you extend your arm and look,
you can't
see it behind your thumb.
Because of perspective.
It should be hidden behind your thumb.
And that's a safe distance.
That's a safe distance. Now, think about the 5-gallon propane tanks and how big the 5-gallon propane tanks are.
5 gallons.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big propane tank. How far away do you need to be? That's where those people are living and they have a fire. What's a safe distance?
Right.
Your building is not going to be a safe distance.
Right.
From that.
Right.
The people walking down the street, walking down the sidewalk, the vehicles that are sitting next to them, those aren't going to be at a safe distance. It's not just a drug and addiction and homelessness problem. It's a public safety problem that involves police. It involves fire. It involves EMS. And so when you say it's a big problem, I think that's where a lot of people get caught because...
Yeah, it's so big. You just don't know where to dive into it.
Yeah. And so often the media cycle, it ends up being like people go for that easy solution, throw more money at it. And I don't think money is the problem. So it's one of the things I do in my daily work is I look for what's really the problem. So if you have something that goes sideways, that's a technical term, by the way.
Yeah.
All right.
That's right. When you have something that goes sideways, you have to be careful about what solutions you go for and what problem you're really trying to solve.
Knock-on effects that you don't expect is what you're saying, I think.
Correct. Yeah. And there are other problems. So is the problem really that the person has this addiction? I would argue, and many in the mental health field might agree, that that's a side effect. The addiction that they have to whatever substance it is a side effect of another deeper problem. This is speaking to acute psychiatric care. You know, you're talking about people who have had exceedingly complicated lives. Okay. So they've grown up with complications. They're probably trauma survivors, usually very early on with substance use and abuse. Escalated from there, burned their social bridges. So they don't have a couch to sleep on anymore. Their family has given up on them. And that's not the fault of the friend or the fault of the family. They have just, because of that addiction and because of the oftentimes the mental health issues that go along with it, they have used up those familial and other resources. Unlike the way our country was, you know, 20 years ago, where, you know, church groups, 20 years ago, 40
maybe
years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Again, my gray hair is showing, my apologies. But that social context so often is lost. We just have grown away from these social contacts, and I might estimate that the real issue, the root cause, is a disconnection from humanity. Mm-hmm. So that's the people who are homeless being disconnected from humanity, but that's also us being disconnected from that humanity.
I can't recall the name. When you say feeling disconnected, I think that's a root cause of a lot of mental distress. For people who are surviving in homes and so forth. We're expected here in the United States to be very independent and don't feel like they can rely on their neighbors or fall back on these communities that churches provide. We need alternative communities then to help address these issues.
Yeah.
That's not something money fixes. Like, we can't use money to make people talk to their neighbors and make friends.
Yeah, and that's exactly. And so that's part of the reason why, while it is a complicated issue, and again, on a daily basis, my work is dealing with complicated issues, right? And so you try and boil it down to the root cause, and then you start working on solutions to that root cause. If you don't break it down to the root cause and you deal with some surface symptom, then you're attacking the wrong problem, and that root cause still exists.
I'm glad we're talking about this, because in the 80s, we had involuntary locked psychiatric care that disbanded, right? And probably legitimately so, because there was some horrible things happening, right?
Sure.
But then what happened, cities all over were having homelessness problems. So the question in my mind is, now we don't have locked involuntary care. And that's...
We do, but...
It has to be criminal, right?
But what it often takes, not always, because there is a civil commitment process, but typically, and this is again part of the larger issue and what makes the system complicated, is oftentimes in order for people to get into a system of, we'll say, forced help, where you're taking your medications. That's right. just what's going to happen today. It's almost required that they go through the criminal justice system in order to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the system that one could argue is broken.
Because there's no medium in this system. There's either you're completely on your own, you're handling, you're swinging your care yourself, you're either setting it up or continuing it or monitoring it yourself, whether that be through medication or talk therapy or whatever, or you're in a locked facility and it's not happening. But there's no medium, i.e., I don't know if I've told this story before on a different one, but when my husband was doing indigent defense work, being the attorney representing people who can't afford to pay for their defense, he did that for a few years right out of law school. He would say a lot of people in that situation, they actually want help, but there's either not help available or it's hard to access or whatnot. And he was saying, you know, if we even could find a way to figure out a system where, since, as you said, Richard, they don't have family, they don't have friends, they don't have a connection who's even just looking in on them to like make sure they're taking their medication. And something so simple like that could keep them out of the criminal justice system, because they don't really belong in the criminal justice system, but that's like the only way they're accessing mental health care. Not that they're trying to be a criminal in order to access mental health care, but it does seem like they are intimately connected.
It is one of the more frequent critiques of our current system is the criminalization of the mentally ill. And while there is a lot of truth to that, there's also a lot that happens and that can happen to divert people who are experiencing a mental health crisis long before they get there. Right.
Yeah.
So that's part of the key, is getting that intervention to happen earlier on in the process, so the person doesn't get into that crisis mode where they're destructive, where they're destroying property, where they're assaulting others or threatening to assault others, those behaviors that would get them into the criminal justice system. Unfortunately, in our current system, once people get into the mental health system by way of a criminal justice system, it sort of gets them in a cycle where they're out in the community, whether they've served their time in quotation marks, or they were released and not charged or whatever. Now the LEDS system, right? The law enforcement data system. And now the next time the police have, or law enforcement have, an opportunity to connect with them, they're already in the system. It complicates things, because then, again, it sort of redirects them in the criminal justice system back into the mental health system. And so that's a difficult cycle to get out of for most people.
It's a catch-22, really. For a country that has a large population of Christians, which the premise is supposed to be about forgiveness.
And caring for one another.
There seems to be a sense of, if I follow the rules, if I behave, if I am normal and I take care of myself, that when somebody else doesn't do well within the structure of our society, that they should be punished for it. And I also think that if you have never taken drugs, you may not understand how it could make somebody who is inherently a good person do terrible things to themselves or to others, or destroy property. And there's this really punitive. Thank you. There's some words I read all the time and I realize I've never actually said them out loud.
Punitive would be like a person that uses puns too much. What? I think. Punitive.
I like puns.
Nice.
And I think one of the problems is that people come from other environments. They visit a place like San Francisco or Portland and they see the more visible symptoms of homelessness. Like, they see people standing by the on-ramps or off-ramps to get onto the freeway. They see the garbage. They see extreme situations. What they're not seeing are all those people that are pushed into homelessness by unaffordable housing that are just getting by, you know, and then they're, you know, you may not notice them. Michael and I would be somewhere and you'd realize that person behind you in line, it's homeless.
Yeah.
You know, they're not acting weird or whatever, but you can just, you can tell like by the shoes and the bottom of the pants, how much stuff they're carrying in their backpack and things like that. Those people are really struggling to get by, and then they're not getting support because the public has such an emotional response to the people that have really extreme behaviors. That's the struggle. Is, I mean, everybody needs more affordable housing. That's just not just homeless. But New York Times had an article recently talking about how homelessness is a greater issue on the West Coast. We have the most expensive housing system. And so what they were saying in the article is that people like to constantly say, oh, it's all drug addicts and so forth. People are really struggling to survive, and then they're getting pushed out there. So they probably already had underlying challenges with living.
Well,
right?
let's ask Richard, because when we had our pre-interview, I said a lot of the same things. What sure. do you think?
Yeah, the lack of affordable housing may play into it. Again, that's one of many factors. There's lots of kids that came from families that could certainly afford to live in a safe environment. Well, just whatever that looks like, if it's an apartment or if it's a house or, you know, whatever. So they live in a safe, they grew up living in a safe environment. And then they got exposed to alcohol or drugs or, you know, addiction. And that became their coping mechanism. And one thing led to another. Again, they've lost the social structure and support from family and from friends, et cetera. And once they've started heading down that road, of course, you know, their employment history is likely complicated. You know, their ability to pay anything for housing. Affordable housing isn't going to correct
so
that,
if they
right?
can get a job, they probably can't get a job to afford housing.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And even if they do hold down that job, being homeless, where are they going to shower? Where are they going to clean up?
How do they show up on time if there's a police raid on their community?
How do they show up on time when they're, you know, maybe they're reliant on the bus route, but getting to the bus, that again makes it more complicated than just, again, the easy solution, throwing money at whatever problem or throwing legislation at the problem of affordable housing. That is one factor, yes. Again, if we go down below that and we look to the connectedness to the community. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons hypothesized for the success of mm-hmm. 12-step groups is it's not just the connectedness to this 12-step group. You've also got a sponsor.
Right.
That's like family.
That's family on steroids.
Right? Like, because they're volunteering. They're putting their hand up and saying, you call me first.
Correct.
You call me at any time.
It's a lifeline. Right.
It's a lifeline. From my perspective, it really is about connectedness and connectedness in communities that we can look to as the base. If we can begin to repair that while we're also working on availability of shelters or of, we'll say, affordable housing. Again, define affordable housing. If we start legislating the provision of housing, where does that stop? That starts getting really expensive because it's not just providing the housing. It's the water and the electricity and the upkeep, because if a person is having issues with addiction, they're not likely to be paying attention
to take care of themselves. Take care of a roof.
Even having the ability to take mm-hmm. care of themselves, let alone, you know, 400 or 600 or whatever it is square feet of space, that space ends up being negatively impacted, and that negative impact then verges
now they're back
that.
In the criminal justice system maybe.
And this brings me back to my
because
point
they've
about
destroyed their house or something has happened and
they've yeah. destroyed property that right. fundamentally belongs to somebody else.
Right.
And we love to be punitive, so we're going to criminalize drug addiction, we're going to criminalize mental health, and we're also mental health issues, we also are going to criminalize being homeless.
I think my point is a little more subtle, and I think what Richard is saying is they're bagging the mental health system because now whoever owns the building has to either fix the building on their own dime or decide whether they're going to somehow press charges against this person. Are they taking them to small claims court? Are they actually having the sheriff evict them? And now we bring the
it's an expensive problem, and people hate to be taxed. And I remember having a conversation with a neighbor in San Francisco, and I said, look, nobody likes to pay more taxes, but you are not paying somebody else's bills. You're paying to have a clean street. And we are creating issues for people just walking down the street.
I had a friend who was attacked. She's getting a lot of hand movements now. I'm going to give you honorary Italian status in a moment.
I did live in Italy for a term.
Yeah. And I am Italian, folks. Don't get mad at me. I'm happy to use my hands when I talk.
As somebody pays taxes, I would love to pay less taxes. But when I think about, like, people saying, well, I don't want to pay for somebody else doing cocaine or whatever, I was like, okay, first of all, like, nobody living on the streets can afford cocaine. So, but that's a whole other topic. But it's just, if you think of it as, oh, I'm just footing someone else's bill, how about thinking of it as, like, I would like to walk through the park and feel safe walking through the park. I would like to go to the beach and not see garbage dumped out in the parking lot.
Right.
That's how I see it. So I'm not trying to be like a communist or socialist or whatever so-called insult people like to throw out there. It's just like the point of taxes are to influence behavior. That's what I learned in civics, right?
Yep.
But also to take care of things that are really communal property. And I think that's what makes people so angry is they want to go to the park, smell the roses, walk their dog, and they're finding needles, garbage, right, human feces. And it's like, okay, so wouldn't you want to pay like an extra $100 just to not see that's yeah, how
let's
I look
talk
at
about
it.
The cost.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point, because say we provide the funding for crews to come. So Central City Concern in Portland is one organization that assists. There are other organizations, other groups that help with cleanup and help keep the streets, we'll say, in quotation marks again, you can't see my air quotes, clean. But that runs into a problem, because if it comes time to, and as part of the cleanup process, to move somebody's personal property or someone to another location in order to, again, in quotation marks, clean things up, then that starts getting problematic. Let's say they resist a little bit, or they assault somebody and as part of that process, or, and probably much more frequently, that experience is so disempowering for the individual to whom that is happening that it creates a short-term crisis for them, and they're not able to compensate for that.
You're listening to Internal Chatter. I'm your host, Melissa Beatty, with co-host Stacey Hunter. And today we're interviewing Richard Ott, former Director of Risk Management and Internal Controls at Oregon State Hospital, and currently working as a multidimensional compliance privacy officer, risk manager, safety officer at the Portland Clinic. When we return, we're going to continue talking with Richard about mental health and its juxtaposition with the criminal justice system. More Internal Chatter is on the way.
A big thank you to our founding partners at Morrell Inc. Print and Marketing for their ongoing support of community radio. Morrell Inc. is a woman-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop that since 1993 has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative printing and marketing solutions. Morrell Inc.'s experienced staff creates partnerships with their clients and uses the latest technologies to meet their needs. More information about which of Morrell Inc.'s products, printing, and marketing strategies will best serve your next project and budget can be found at morrellinc.com. That's MORELINK.com.
Did you know that you can schedule an appointment or ask Planned Parenthood questions by phone, chat, text, computer, or in person? At Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette, they know that sexual and reproductive care is needed now, maybe more than ever. Their health center locations in Oregon and Southwest Washington are open and ready when you are. Visit ppcw.org. That's ppcw.org to learn more today.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Richard Ott, former Director of Risk Management and Internal Controls at Oregon State Hospital, about the intersection between mental health and the criminal justice system.
We haven't decided as a country if prison is really for punishment or as punishment. And there's a difference.
Clarify, right? Please.
So if you're sending somebody out of the community to a prison as punishment, that looks a bit different than if you're sending them to prison for punishment, meaning punishment is what happens while you are in prison. So the confinement is your punishment. The way you're treated when you're in prison or in jail is punishment, as opposed to you being segregated from the community and put in that condition is the punishment.
That's a subtle difference. Sure. Yeah.
That's a subtle difference.
I never thought about that.
One is an absolute hell.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about torture chambers and being hung by your wrists.
Correct.
Yeah.
And either way you look at that, there are lots of disputes about the functionality of that process.
I would add a third one, too. It's a deterrent. Yeah. And I would argue in a lot of cases, I'm not sure it is a deterrent.
For each of us, we probably have a memory of what we would think of as our worst day.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So as a firefighter EMT, I have regularly gone out and helped people through what they probably will remember as their worst day.
For sure.
Right? What some people in addiction and recovery might think of as the rock bottom, that's going to look different for different people. What that worst day and what rock bottom looks like when you're in the middle of a mental health and or addiction crisis, going to prison, that's going to jail, that's not even on your roadmap.
It's not a deterrent. It's not a concern.
If you are experiencing your life and you are compensating for the stressors in your life, maybe that's a deterrent. Somebody who is in the depths of their addiction and or mental health crisis, who is living on the streets in maybe a provided tent, but maybe a scrounged tarp, right? Going to prison or going to jail, especially if you've already been there, that's not likely to be a deterrent.
And I think this also kind of doubles back to the cost. Stacey, you were talking about getting frustrated when people say they don't want to pay for stuff. I would say we already are paying for it. And I think some of the numbers...
mismanaged.
You're already paying for it. You're just paying for it poorly.
So we're paying for it, for the police to go and do their raids, and we're paying for janitorial services to come clean up, and we're paying for pickup in the park, but we're not paying to prevent...
Correct.
That's what I'm getting at from a risk management perspective.
But honorary Italian status too.
For sure. We're all up here.
Oh, absolutely.
Hands up in the air.
Absolutely. At any rate, again, if we keep throwing money at these symptoms of the problem, homelessness or affordable housing or, quote, cleaning up the streets, we're throwing money at these symptoms of the deeper problem, which is a disconnection.
The lack of connection to any kind of smaller group that you feel like this is my tribe. These are my people.
Correct.
They know me. I know them.
Correct.
Know their lives.
Correct.
Yeah.
Living in a homeless community or an unsheltered community, whatever terminology, that then becomes their connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That becomes their community, and that is inherently unsafe. Where's your next meal coming from? Do you have to worry about somebody accosting you in the middle of the night because you're in a tent or because you're under a tarp?
And this is the reason some people avoid the shelters, right? Because they have a pet or a child or they've been attacked, and they feel safer being on their own than in a shelter.
You gave me an astounding statistic, and this would be cost from a few years ago even.
Yeah.
So you had said for locked psychiatric care, we're talking about $30,000 a month?
Correct.
And
holy
for
cow.
Correct.
Residential care, not locked, but like a supervised residential care situation, $5,000 a month.
Four to five-ish.
So we're talking about like a six-fold decrease in cost.
You're also talking about more individuals that would be in need of those services outside of a locked setting than there would be inside of a locked setting. But you're also looking at the cost, again, with the criminal justice system being the feeder, the expense of having somebody in a prison or in a jail as opposed to in locked psychiatric care.
Right. And then even below that, let's say there was a medium solution. Let's say there was groups of nurse paired with police officer to go around and make sure people on some sort of system get their meds, are checking in with them, are providing a connection point where people can get services and that sort of thing. So that's, let's say, even less cost per month, let's say. Let's have interventions at a much earlier stage and divert people getting to that level. I believe is kind of where you're driving at.
So maybe to touch back with the proactive versus reactive measures, right? Getting somebody through the criminal justice system and into the mental health system, that's all reactive measures. Think about it from a systems perspective as opposed to like a mental health perspective or a affordable housing perspective. Anytime you have a reactive strategy, you're likely going to be less efficient and obviously more expensive with that intervention to achieve the same outcome. In Oregon, if you are found guilty except for insanity, so that's a plea that you provide if you have been if you're being charged with a crime as your defense, you say, yes, I did it, but I wasn't in my right mind when I did it. In Oregon, that is a non-guilty plea.
Okay.
So you're really saying, I didn't do it, or I'm not responsible for it because I wasn't in my right mind when it happened. So if you are found guilty except for insanity, you then go under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, which is the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Once you're under the board, you are given the maximum amount of time for your crime under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. As an example, let's say you set fire to a mailbox stand. You might even get time served. If you just said, yes, I did that, and I'm sorry about it, pay some restitution, you certainly wouldn't end up spending, in all likelihood, 20 years in jail, right? However, if you say, yes, I did it, but guilty except for insanity, then you go under the jurisdiction of the PSRB for 20 years. Now, that doesn't...
No, wait a minute. So they're not a sentencing body. They reevaluate you throughout this 20-year period, regardless of the what happened.
Correct.
Interesting.
Correct. So you're under the jurisdiction of the PSRB for the maximum time allotted for your crime. And in that time, they track you. The PSRB would track you and your case, and if it seems like you're doing well, you can be under the jurisdiction of the PSRB and living independently in the community. Absolutely possible, and it does happen. It also happens that people are under the jurisdiction of the PSRB and they get into locked psychiatric care, and then they find themselves in a community-based setting, and they're still under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. Again, that's not a bad thing.
Community meaning what?
Meaning like a group home.
Okay.
Or
halfway house or...
There's lots of
variations on that.
There's lots of variations on that. But the PSRB is really responsible for saying, yes, that's an adequate placement for you, and they would approve that placement. Let's just, as a hypothetical, one of the conditions of your conditional release from locked psychiatric care might be that you don't do drugs. And it's found that you had been under the effect of some intoxicant that is not part of your conditional release.
Right.
So the PSRB may say, you violated the conditions of your conditional release, and you get remanded back to the custody of the state hospital.
Mm. Well, I mean, to bring up previous questions, does that work as a deterrent?
To me,
if you have an addiction and you're slipping,
it's also part of that same problem that if you're psychiatrically unstable and you gain benefit from medications, and those increase your psychiatric stability and make you able to hold things together, it is not uncommon at all for people to not want to continue taking those psychiatric medications. And so
because
it may be a variety of things. It may be the cost of those psychiatric medications. It may be because the nature of mental illness is a cycle. And you may cycle up a little bit and not want to continue taking your medications or not be thinking about taking your medications because you think you're doing better. And so you stop taking your medications or you stop having access to get your medications. Again, not uncommon. People start tapering or they stop altogether or they get sidetracked and they get into doing something else, often associated with self-medication. And that creates psychiatric instability. One of the benefits, I'll put benefits in a huge air quote, but one of the benefits of locked psychiatric care is that they can mandate medications in that environment. They cannot mandate medications in a group home environment. One of the things I didn't touch on earlier, which is also part of locked psychiatric care, the civil commitment process. Somebody who poses immediate dangerousness to self or others, so mm-hmm. they're in imminent danger of self to others, they can not have committed a crime or not be charged with a crime, but be civilly committed by a judge. They're in that same kind of system where there is the capacity, it's not as common, but there is the capacity to force medication, irrespective of the person's choice.
But hold on a second. This civil commitment, to get to that point, to be told by a judge, this is what's best for you, mm-hmm. you have to have already gone pretty far down the path. And there's so much behavior that happens absolutely. Before they even get to that point.
Yeah. So, yes, and that really speaks to, again, kind of sort of the base of the pillar that I'm talking about, which is connectedness to communities. That is a potential solution on which to focus as along with some focus on these other symptoms of the problem. To use the analogy of somebody who has cancer, that cancer may create a lot of other symptoms. It might create lightheadedness. It might create nausea. It might create, whatever. The treatment for that cancer, you're not going to expect the treatment for that cancer to be an anti-nausea medication. Right. You can fix a symptom with the anti-nausea medication, but that is not going to touch the cancer. I don't remember who did the study, so unfortunately I can't quote it, and there may be more than one. So heroin addiction is one of the most complicated and most problematic addictions to sort of break that cycle. And yet there was a group that seemed to do it comparatively with ease. And that was people who were returning to the United States from military service in the Vietnam War. So heroin was a big deal at that time.
Like while they were in country.
While they were in that environment, in the military, doing that thing, and they got out of that environment, came back to the United States, and for whatever reason, I believe connectedness to communities, that they were more successful at breaking
their
addiction than other groups.
They're also removed from the environment in which they actually established the behavior.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Precisely. So often in our criminal justice system, particularly the mental health cycle, right, people that get into the criminal justice system are remanded back to their county of origin. If you committed a crime in Malheur County and you are found guilty except for insanity and you go to the state hospital, Malheur County is still, they still are responsible. And so typically what happens is those people then go back to Malheur County or back to Multnomah County or back to whatever county of origin.
Which could be the original source of trauma.
Which could be the original source
the original
of trauma.
The original people they hang out
where
with.
Where they already got their yeah. sources. So, you know, again,
complicated.
It's complicated, and yet we have this expectation that people are going to go back to their county of origin and get better, and they're still experiencing, in all likelihood, the same disconnection from not necessarily from resources, but that feeling of connection, right? That sense of connectedness to others.
That someone cares about you. Someone, you're important to somebody.
Correct.
I'm the host of Internal Chatter, Melissa Beatty, with co-host Stacey Hunter. And joining us on the chat today is Richard Ott, former director of risk management and internal controls at Oregon State Hospital and currently working with the Portland Clinic.
Domestic violence is not okay, and it's on the rise, especially now during this time of COVID-19. Domestic violence comes in many forms, such as physical abuse, verbal, financial, sexual, stalking, and technological abuses. If you or someone you know is in an abusive relationship, we can help. The Vancouver Police Department and the YWCA are here for you. You are not alone, even in this time of crisis. You can call the YWCA at 360-695-0501 or call 911 for the police. You can also find helpful information about the Safe Choice Domestic Violence Program at ywcaclarkcounty.org and in Portland at ywcapdx.org.
KXRW Radio would like to help spread the word about food availability. head to clarkcountyfoodbank.org and click on Find Food to access a map and a printable list of pantry locations throughout the region where you can pick up food to take home. That's clarkcountyfoodbank.org.
Have you always wanted to buy a washing machine and support affordable housing at the same time? Well, now you can at the Clark County Habitat for Humanity store. They have furniture, appliances, building materials, rugs, paint, flooring, tile, and tons of other new and gently used items. Every purchase supports home building projects right here in Clark County. You can donate your own things too. Or better yet, you can call 360-213-1313. That's 360-213-1313. And they'll come pick them up from your home. The Clark County Habitat for Humanity store is located on Southeast 2nd Street near the corner of Mill Plain and I-205. They have everything and the kitchen sink.
Chatter. I'm your host, Melissa Beatty, with co-host Stacey Hunter. Before the break, we were chatting with Richard Ott, former director of risk management and internal controls at Oregon State Hospital and currently working at the Portland Clinic. It seems like, too, the changing of the workplace, i.e. women, because women didn't used to work in large numbers, right, until it was really World War II. And I'm not arguing that women shouldn't be allowed to work or some craziness like that, because I don't think that's the right attitude to have. Right. But there was an enormous component to this free labor that does not exist anymore. And I say this as a mother, too. I think a lot of the reason why people get postpartum depression, I know I did, was this realization that I'm in this myself. I do not have any support. Mm-hmm. And this is a massive undertaking. Breaking.
And here I am, like,
and I'm fairly privileged, right? And I'm struggling to just keep my head above water.
And what you're saying is what I've heard from my other mom friends as well. But if we go back to what you brought up, is that what's happened in economically is women went to work, but our economy has also changed. Where it's like, it's even if let's say that people were like, well, women should go back home, we can't. Well, we can't afford single income families anymore. And most families need two incomes.
I don't want to argue that.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is there used to be, I think a lot of these connected spaces that Richard, you are talking about, really were
powered by women.
They were organized by women. They were manned. That's funny. They were operated by women. These were the people that were creating
volunteer
not
work.
Just social clubs, but
connectedness.
The connectedness within communities,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they were home. And I am not arguing because I don't think that's fulfilling for everybody. I think it should be a little more distributed, right? But there is something that has gone missing that is not being funded, that is this kind of intangible thing of connectedness like you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the question is, okay, how do we fund that stuff? Do we make that happen? Because it's not going back.
Can I bring up something? Yeah. So the reason why I brought up the economics of it is because if everybody has to go to work full time, who has time to volunteer?
Right.
And one thing I love about the company that I work for is they create all sorts of volunteer opportunities that can happen on the clock.
Again, if we think about it from this perspective of connectedness, the Elks Lodges.
Mm-hmm. Fraternal
organizations.
So more people join.
If we could get back to that space, it could get people away from the TV and the 24-hour news cycle. And at the same time, we are losing those things that kept us connected to one another in a community.
I mean, yes, we could all just stop doing Instagram, but that a lot of people feel that they don't have time for themselves, let alone time to volunteer.
Right.
And it's like, I think there needs to be an overhaul in our attitudes of what our lifestyle should be like. Is it really, you know, we all really want to work 40 plus hours a week and be exhausted
care about our neighbors? That's exactly what I was going to say is like, I've always felt like when you're young, 8 hours, okay, that goes on for a little while.
It was easy.
Let me tell you what, I am lucky enough where I don't have the 9-to-5 anymore. I can't imagine. I only have one kid. I can't, and I never get time enough for myself, I feel like. Enough that I need, right?
Yeah, but that sort of speaks to, in some ways, that speaks to the point, and not to put too fine a point on it, but we have tended in our modern culture to be so focused on the, well, time for me.
Uh-huh.
Right. Mm-hmm. That and, you know, again, having worked in organizations that have limited funding, right, it's not about the funding you have. It's about where you put it. Right. It's about your priorities. We all have limited time. If our priority is, you know, my cell phone and my, you know, my new car or my big shiny house or, you know, whatever it is, if that's the priority is not connectedness to the community.
That's a very good point.
And so if we assign a priority to helping one another,
which is going to require a degree of discomfort.
Yeah. And, yes. And one of the most simple things that we could as a human being ever say with the most significant consequences is, what can I do to help?
Yeah.
What can I do to help at work? What can I do to help for my neighbor? One of the things that in my, you know, many, many years, more than a decade in the fire service, it was exceedingly rare for us to arrive on scene helping the person who made the call. It was almost always a family member, a neighbor, a friend, a bystander, whatever, that was making the call for this person who needed help. So I use that as an example. Again, fire service, long time, and went on many, many, many calls. We have wonderful human beings doing great things all the time. And it doesn't get reported. And if we knew about that kind of stuff happening all the time and we saw it happening, we might be more inclined to do that too.
It would model that behavior and show people what's possible.
Correct. And it's not just possible. One of the reasons I've said this for years, one of the reasons why I got involved in the fire service, I had been the first responder on like multiple car accidents. I stopped counting at like 25 just because I was there to see it happen, and it mattered to me to try and help. And I finally decided, you know what, if this is what the universe is going to be bringing my way, I might as well know what the hell I'm doing. And so if we come at it with that perspective of what can I do to help, it may get us closer to that sense of community that can help keep people from getting into that mental health crisis. So one of the phrases is we fear the unknown, and I don't know that that's really the case. I think we know that somebody who is psychiatrically unstable may threaten us in some way.
It can be dangerous.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it can be dangerous, and it's that dangerousness that we fear, right? And we know that. So I don't know that it's that we fear the unknown, but oftentimes we have a fear of helping somebody else, in particular in a kind of a public setting, because we're afraid it might go sideways. But if we saw those examples more, if we had that perspective fostered more, maybe it would help us as individuals be more, I won't say compassionate, that was my instinct, but I think that's not accurate.
Productive and actually solving the
issue. Active. Right. It would keep us, because we all have that compassion. We all sort of feel we feel bad for them.
Well, that's the discomfort I referred to earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. But we never get we don't often get to that place of saying, what can I do to help?
Yeah.
We have an expectation that our government is going to be the one to help them. We have an expectation that that our city council is going to, you know, develop a plan. We have these expectations about what help for them might look like. And we are disconnected from that. Right. So, and we don't have a good system for somebody who wants to help for making a call, for example, something that would keep them safe, and it's something I can do to help, making a call to an organization that could come and help them.
So what
we have is that person doesn't get the quote help, again in air quotes, they don't get the help that they need until the store that they're in says they're trespassing, or until they throw a brick through a window.
And now we're back to the
and we get them back
into the criminal justice system,
exactly.
Mental health system.
Now I know.
some might say do anything, even if it doesn't work, then we can change it.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Try
different ways of doing it, because right now, clearly what we're doing isn't working. And to further my point, the money that we are continuously throwing at the homelessness problem, whether it be in San Francisco or Portland or Seattle or
prison
wherever
systems.
In the prison system, is not working.
So there's a certain amount of people that are going to have, let's say, biologic components to mental health, and those are going to need big-time care all their life, we'll say.
Yeah. You're talking about that funnel, right?
Down at the bottom of the funnel. You're saying there's a small percentage of the population that has permanent challenges, maybe even been born with them.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so we're not talking about those guys right now. That's a separate – like, I think there are these segmented groups within – people who end up in a locked facility, or people who end up with care needed for the rest of their life, different levels of care, what works for them. So, like, I think within the homelessness community, I mean, maybe part of our issues as a society is we're looking at it like, well, what is the one solution that fixes it all? There isn't one.
Correct.
So maybe there is, maybe we need to have five different kinds of solutions, because I think there are also people who are homeless who are legitimately, like, they have had a medical bankruptcy. And now their family is on the street. And before, they had a full-time job, and through no fault of their own, maybe they did have a wackadoo cancer and they've literally gone medically bankrupt, right? So how do we get – they're struggling with things that are not at all like the people that have come up with like a trauma from being sexually abused as a child, right? Like these are completely different types of things, but they're all – not being housed.
Yeah.
So we can't solve – those are different root causes, right?
Correct. Yeah. And that's – I think that's part of what – I think where the solution lies is customizable solutions based on the individual's need. Of course, that requires a functional assessment of where the individual is at. It also requires a system that says you can't because you are unsafe or you're creating a lack of safety in your community, you need to participate. We can't really let you say no.
Yeah, well, that was going to be kind of a question that I had was, you know, at the top, I was like, we used to have forced, involuntary commitment. That went sideways.
It was absolutely a broken system, but there was part of it that worked.
That worked. And I was kind of wondering if the pendulum is kind of swinging back, and maybe we will have a system where there is going to be more circumstances where and maybe more options within this kind of forced help system. I mean, maybe the forced help system isn't necessarily you're locked in care, but maybe the forced help system is you need to be where we can make sure you're getting once a week care.
I saw a news story recently about that kind of system where social work and medical personnel are the ones being dispatched, potentially even along with police, for these what really are mental health emergencies or physical health emergencies, rather than dispatching police when somebody is behaving erratically. I believe that people need to be responsible for their actions, and at the same time, as a society, we need to grow to be able to hold two things simultaneously.
Be more dynamic in our responses.
Yeah. Well, that we can say, yes, this person is acting dangerously, and at the same time what they need is help, not incarceration.
What I'm getting out of all this is several things. Is understanding what our local resources are is something that we can those are immediate steps that we can take to communicate if you see a situation, what are some possible resources similar to what we talked about for suicide. I'm also getting out of this that any small things that we can do to help people feel connected around us is a preventative step.
Joining us on the chat today is Richard Ott, former director of risk management and internal controls at Oregon State Hospital and currently working with the Portland Clinic. Thank you, Richard. Your articulateness, your wealth of knowledge the breadth and depth you bring to this topic are really amazing. I have learned a lot. I have also been inspired. I have actually been so inspired by all of the guests because it occurs to me, and you're for sure at the top of the list at the moment. I have time. I could be doing more. Now, I don't need to do so much that I put myself into a mental crisis.
Yeah, you can't be expected to provide help to others in such a way that it becomes detrimental to you.
Right.
However,
I think there is room, and I think that you've been very inspiring. Like, one of the reasons why I started this show, is because I want people to see there is help in the community. Because when you listen to a national radio show, I think it's great. It's inspirational to me. I hear new information. Okay, cool. Good podcast, whatever. But that person doesn't seem accessible to me. They're on the national stage.
I see. You're disconnected from them.
On the nose. Yeah. Yes, I'm disconnected from them. But I think there is more that I can do in my personal life. Your overall idea about connectedness, I think, is it underpins everything that we've seen come through this show. It's spot on. I mean, it seems like every person that we've had has echoed that in some capacity. But I really appreciate your just kind of ability to line it out so clearly and why it matters, because it sounds like this really fluffy topic, but it has some real teeth to it. And I think you're very articulate in being able to speak your mind on it. So thank you for coming to the show.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for the opportunity to come and connect with you and connect with Stacey. It's been a very long time, so I really appreciate that. And thank you for the opportunity for me to help you guys give voice to this really critical issue that belongs out in the public. Again, the only way to really fix the problem is to get to the root cause and start working on it. And the only way we can do that is by talking about it.
Yeah.
That's where it starts.
We're delighted. I mean, selfishly, I just love seeing everybody that's been a part of my life. And I'm so honored that I know so many great people, you included, that has gone on to these wonderful things. So
thank you. And just a brief disclaimer, any comments I make during this broadcast should not be construed as affiliated with my employers, previous or current.
Yes. Richard's speaking on his own. I am not official spokesperson of either organization, which is fair to say. If you want to contact Richard, please contact us at Internal Chatter and we'll put you into contact with him.
Listen to past episodes, join the conversation, and connect with Internal Chatter at internalchatter.com. Ready to discover more KXRW offerings? Find Vancouver's voice at kxrw.fm or on Facebook at KXRW Vancouver. You can also hear a rebroadcast of Internal Chatter on our Portland station, X-Ray. Community radio like this is made possible with the generous support of listeners like you. To donate, please visit kxrw.fm and click the yellow donate button. This is Melissa Beatty and Stacey Hunter thanking you and hoping you join us again next time when we bring mental health into the daily dialogue on Internal Chatter.